The next case on our calendar is 06673 and 06798 in re SJK Minor. Justice O'Connor has recused herself from this case. We're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice O'Connor. Judge Susan Brown is a judge of the Court of Appeals in the 10th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Brown. Mr. Warhatch.
Thank you, Your Honor, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the members of the court. I'm David Warhatch. I represent the appellant, SJK, in these proceedings. I see it's Summit County Day here, and I'm glad to be part of the festivities. I am here before you because the Summit County Juvenile Court found my client culpable of the traffic offense of reckless operation of vehicle. And my client went ahead and paid the fines and costs before his parents made the decision that an appeal should be filed with respect to the issue of speedy trial rights, which was preserved in the court below. So what you have before us, what you have before you is the mootness question. I'm going to ask the court, Mr. Chief Justice, to allow myself to retain as much as 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
You need to watch your time.
But what we have before us is the question of what does the mootness standard really mean in this state as applied to the question of automatic assessment of points on a driving record and whether or not that constitutes sufficient collateral disability so as to preserve the justiciability of issues that are on appeal. In this particular situation, my client was told by the magistrate to pay the fines and costs on the next business day of the court, which is what he did. Of course, the decision on whether to appeal or not was one that was left to his parents, since he was a minor at the time of the offense, and he didn't have the resources to decide to take an appeal. And the decision on the appeal was made in my office about 2 weeks later, during well within the 30 days to file the appeal.
Was it contemplated at the time of the plea?
I'm sorry?
Was the plea contemplated at the time of the plea?
This was a trial, Your Honor. My client contested the substantive charges as well and was found culpable.
Was there any indication there that there would be appeal?
Certainly, because the first issue was an issue raised in the context of a motion to dismiss on the grounds that the speedy trial rights had been violated. The magistrate overruled that motion and then proceeded to the trial.
Okay.
So the question here is, of course, the well-understood standards for mootness are, would the reversal of this case on appeal be wholly ineffectual in reestablishing the status quo, or in affording relief or any particular advantage to the appellant? And we believe that the mere imposition of the points is enough. In fact, 5 appellate judicial districts have held the same way. The 4th District, the 5th District, the 7th and the 8th Districts, and the 11th District, 5 of them have held this way, and only the 9th District stands alone in saying that that's not a sufficient collateral disability. So the court is now charged with the constitutional responsibility of resolving those conflicts within the districts. The court has faced this issue a couple of different times in different contexts in a criminal matter. In the 1975 case of Wilson, the court established that the standard is whether or not there is no possibility of any collateral adverse consequences to the appellant. And in that case, the court decided that, in fact, the record has to be devoid of any such inference that there can be any such collateral disability. In 1987, I believe it is, this court confronted the case of Berndt, B-E-R-N-D-T. And in that case, which is the principal one on which the prosecution relies, the holding of the court in that particular case was that because the appellant did not include in the record any evidence of collateral disability, there could be no finding. In this particular case, I'll let you know that the specific way this issue came up prevented me from putting anything into the record any more than what the law provides with respect to the automatic imposition of points and the inferences that come with that in terms of the adverse consequences on one's insurance rates. What happened in this situation was that the Court of Appeals was confronted by a motion to dismiss, and the Court of Appeals overruled it, relying on one of those cases that said that the imposition of points was enough to preserve justiciability. But then after hearing the merits of the case, The court reached back to that previous decision and said, oh, no, we mean to reverse that and say that, in fact, we disagree with the Ingalls case and all the others, and we think that the mere imposition of points is not enough collateral disability. So at a minimum, I was not given an opportunity, because the Court of Appeals never gave me an opportunity, to make a record even at the appellate level of all the other facts that might support the question of continued viability or justiciability here. But the dissent in Berndt is actually one I'd like you to focus on, because I am not asking the court to overturn Wilson. And Berndt is kind of an odd case, because I don't know exactly what was motivating this court on the record. But the Chief Justice and two other members of the court at that time wrote a dissent, which I think should actually serve as the hallmark of the decision in this case. Because the court actually essentially took my argument in the Court of Appeals, and the dissent took my argument in the Court of Appeals and helped me frame it, because I was able to draw upon the analysis that was given by Justice Brown and the Chief Justice, and I can't remember if a Justice Wright, I think. And I think that the fact that the court has the ability to recognize that for a juvenile in particular, someone who is found culpable of reckless operation of vehicle, the profound effect on their insurance rates is immediate. They also receive an automatic assessment of points that they can't get around and cannot appeal, except through the appeal of the judgment of culpability, and that assessment of points edges them closer and closer to the revocation or suspension of their license. In addition to that, since I'm very familiar with the life insurance industry, I know that life insurance companies use the driving record of an individual in deciding whether to rate insurance policies.
What you're arguing to us is not in the record, however.
That part is not. The last part is not, Your Honor. The question about the insurance rates is, I did argue that in the Court of Appeals. In addition to that, the issue of the question of insurance rates comes up in the various decisions made by these appellate districts and also in the dissent in Berndt.
I think the state's position is that none of it's in the trial record, and so there's really nothing before the court with respect to evidencing the collateral disability that you're arguing about. Should we take judicial notice of this?
Well, the issue came up in the first instance in the Court of Appeals. There was no issue in the trial court. In fact, when I filed my objections to the magistrate's decision, the state never moved to strike the objections on the grounds that my client had waived any opportunity to raise them because he had paid the fines and costs at that point. The issue never came up at all until the Court of Appeals and after our merit brief was submitted that they filed their motion to dismiss. So what happened in the trial court preserves the substantive issues for appeal. What happens in the Court of Appeals is procedurally how the case got knocked out on mootness grounds. So the mootness question derives its factual basis from the payment of court costs and fines in the trial court, but the Court of Appeals is where all the action was. And if I may, I listened to the argument by learned counsel opposite in the previous case, and I was impressed by his use of the doctrines that I've used as an alternative theory in this case to preserve the justiciability of the issues. The questions presented by us at the appellate court level and in the trial court are of great public and general interest because they involve the question of whether or not a juvenile has a speedy trial right, particularly under the post-1996 amendments of Title 29 of the Ohio Revised Code. Those issues ultimately have to be resolved. At this point, at a minimum, the court ought to find that this issue is capable of repetition and yet evades review, and therefore could remand on that basis. But of course, the court also must be mindful of the provisions of Article 1, Section 16 of the Ohio Constitution, as well as the provisions of the Ohio Rules of Appellate Procedure that are to be liberally construed in favor of preserving the right to appeal, protecting that right as one of the fundamental guarantees that are guaranteed to the citizens of this state. If there are no other questions at this point, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Warhatch. Mr. Cassay.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, Richard Cassay representing the Appellee State of Ohio in this case. I'm going to kind of jump around and address points that some various points that Mr. Warhatch made. One general thing I want to say is, and no offense to Mr. Warhatch, but in his brief and continuing on in this court, he makes statements, factual statements, that are simply not in this record. To quote a couple of them, the magistrate told the juvenile to pay this fine personally, and not only to pay it personally, but to pay it on the next business day. That's not in the record. You know, you will look forever and you won't find it.
He did pay it the next day, though, didn't he? He was a juvenile, and he should comply with the court's order, and so he paid it the next day.
I don't know what he felt, Mr. Chief Justice. He did pay it quickly after the decision.
He did better than some adults do in adult court.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Yes. But as far as the magistrate telling him to do that, that's not in the record. Now, if it had been, and this is going to lead me to another point, if that had been in the record, then I think Mr. Warhatch would have a good argument that the payment was not voluntary. And there's precedent, at least from the Ninth District in the Zindel case, that if the payment of the fine is not voluntary, then the case is not moot. But again, not in the record of this case.
Can you help me understand over here? It's not in the record because the transcript was not filed, or there was no transcript from the magistrate's proceeding?
The only transcript that was put into the record on appeal in the Court of Appeals is the transcript in which Mr. Warhatch is arguing to the magistrate his motion to dismiss based on speedy trial grounds. What is not in the record is the trial itself, the evidentiary hearing on the charge of reckless operation and imposition of the sentence. I would infer that at imposition of the sentence would be the place where the magistrate would make these pronouncements that Mr. Warhatch is saying the magistrate made. But that's why, because the transcript was not provided.
Does the transcript contain evidence with respect to the motion for speedy trial, which is really at the heart of what Mr.
That was the argument. That's there.
So we get through this issue on collateral disability, and if you don't prevail, then ultimately we're going back for a review on an issue on speedy trial, apparently, at some point.
Yes, that's correct.
That's the direction.
Yes.
And what you're suggesting is, if I understand it, that there's no evidence of collateral disability because there's no imminent threat to remove the license from this operator, or there's no insurance premium increases in the record? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, number one, we have to keep in mind this is a juvenile we're talking about.
Yes.
So he's got 4 points. I concede that, because the Court of Appeals said he did. So I'm going to say he got 4 points. But I'm not going to say that he has purchased a policy of automobile insurance that the 4 points are going to result in an increase in that rate.
But wouldn't we assume that he's in that as a juvenile, and even not a juvenile, he's in that age range where all the statistics indicate that he is more likely to be involved in an accident in an automobile than persons not in that rate, not in that age range, and so that for him, when he attempts to purchase insurance, automobile insurance, it's likely that he's going to pay more. If he's got 4 points plus being in that age range, that vulnerable age range, that he's going to pay more. Shouldn't we, in a situation like this, shouldn't we sort of err on the side of saying there is some collateral consequence here as a result of his conviction?
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, I think your question leads to one of the major points in this case, and that is the construction or the interpretation of what this court meant in the Wilson case. Now, when you read that, there are essentially two tests. There's the test that's in the syllabus, which says essentially that the person who's arguing that the misdemeanor conviction is not moot must put in evidence from which an inference can be drawn. There's also language in Wilson where the court says that there must be no possibility of collateral consequences or an effect on civil rights. That test, I think, to me at least, is a little broader than the syllabus test, and I think leaves itself open more to the judicial notice type approach. And I would respectfully say that your question, Mr. Chief Justice, is more towards the judicial notice type approach.
If we can find this to simply points, do you admit that the assignment or the assessment of points on the license is itself a collateral disability?
No, because I do not. If I thought that, then I wouldn't be here. It's not a collateral disability under Berndt, if I'm pronouncing that right, because the points in and of themselves really, to my mind, don't mean anything unless it's followed by something. This increase in the insurance, which I think is speculation, loss of license, there's no evidence of that. We just have the points. So, this court in the Berndt case said a different type of situation.
Yes.
Where it was an enhancement, an OMVI case, right, where it could be enhanced. And this court said that that's not enough because all the defendant had to do was obey the law. And he's not going to be faced with anything.
There's no statement of proceedings or stipulation of evidence presented at the Court of Appeals on the insurance question.
There's argument by counsel for the appellant that the insurance rate would be impacted.
Mr. Cassay, the Court of Appeals refers to four separate appellate decisions from three districts and says that they have all ruled that points are sufficient, but did not give rationale for that. Is that your understanding as well?
Well, not giving a rationale, they cited this court's opinions, various of the appellate districts cited this court's opinion in either Wilson and or Berndt and said nothing else. Now, if that's what they did. So the Ninth District interpreted that as not giving a rationale. The appellant is also claiming here that he was prevented or bushwhacked, if that's the word, by the Ninth District in its ultimate decision. What occurred was I filed a motion to dismiss. Mr. Warhatch responded with a motion in opposition and a corrected a motion or brief, and the Court of Appeals overruled the state's motion to dismiss, but the Court of Appeals said we may revisit this issue upon final disposition. Now, the question may arise, well, what can the attorney for the appellant do at that point? Now, in actual fact, nothing was done, but something that could have been done. We go back to this transcript. If the magistrate is ordering him to do these things himself and not the parents, and do it the next day by the transcript, put it into the record, because the case that the Ninth District cited, the Ingalls case, cited the Wilson case. So you know, there is some form of notice here that, number one, the Court of Appeals, the Ninth District, was not done with the issue because they said so, and number two, you can do something about it, you know, and you can do something about it very easily. If, in fact, it would be in the, it would have been in the record that the magistrate did what Mr. Warhat says he did, I would concede that the case is not moot. I would. But it's not there. And I don't think we can just pretend it's there. The point's also been made that the state is stopped by something latches because the state did not object to the appellant's objections in the juvenile court, or maybe the state should have objected to the magistrate's decision because he paid the fine and costs. I don't know. I wasn't able to find any authority on this, and the appellant didn't cite any, but I think that the best answer I can come up with is what the magistrate does. The magistrates aren't in the business of making judgments. They're making recommendations. There's nothing that I know of that because the juvenile traffic offender, or he's adjudicated at that point, pays the fine and costs, that he can't file an objection to the court. The court's going to make the final decision. The magistrate is not making the final decision. Mootness, as I think we're talking about it here, is something developed by the appellate courts. It's not something that I'm aware of that is a doctrine in the trial courts. I might be wrong on that, but I say I wasn't able to find anything. But I don't think the state ever entertained the notion of saying you cannot file an objection under the juvenile rules because you paid the fine and costs and put the issue before the judge. I just don't think that follows. Well, I think in summary, I think this case calls into question, as I say, the language in Wilson. To what extent can judicial notice play a role? Burnt, I think, is very clear that if you obey the law, then you're not going to suffer these otherwise might be termed collateral consequences. Certainly, there's no evidence that Mr. Concilio's license has been suspended for accumulating too many points. So then I have to assume and argue that the Byrne case fits his situation. There is one case that talks about insurance, and that's the Brown case, State versus Brown. All the other conflict cases merely talk about points, but the Brown case, maybe I'm helping Mr. Warhatch out here, but the Brown case does talk about insurance, and it's the only one in that group. But again, Brown, the defendant Brown, is an adult or was an adult. So if the court is considering an approach where judicial notice is proper, then I think you can more obviously or more appropriately take that judicial notice in the case of an adult defendant as opposed to a juvenile defendant, a juvenile traffic offender. In closing, Mr. Warhatch also talked about the doctrines, the various doctrines that militate against the court applying mootness considerations. I think those, for instance, the one I talked about in the prior case, I think those those are arguments that go to the importance of the substantive issue that would be taken away if mootness were applied. In this case, whether or not a juvenile traffic offender has a statutory and or a federal constitutional right to a speedy trial. I think that is an argument, and those are considerations that should have been directed to the Ninth District. and not this court, because this court does not have that issue before it, and will not, even if it reverses the Ninth District, it's not going to have that issue for quite some time. So I don't know that those doctrines are a good fit to this type of situation. With that, my time is just about done, and again, I'll thank the court for its attention.
Thank you, Mr. Cassay. Mr. Warhatch, you've saved a little more than 5.5 minutes of your time.
Mr. Warhatch, let me ask you a question. Do you agree that the points themselves then are not a collateral disability, especially under our holding in Burnt? Is it?
No, I believe that points themselves are enough to establish a collateral disability, and that's not what Burnt says. Burnt actually says...
Well, if we want to reach the point where you are, we would have to overrule Burnt, am I right?
Well, I'm not so sure you would have to, because I don't know what was going on the record of that case, because you have to read between the lines to really understand why the court, on a 4-3 basis, held that appellant in that case failed to put anything in the record to show a collateral disability. That's what the decision was. I think the dissent correctly points out that not only was that factually wrong on the record, but all these other issues that I've raised in this appeal militate against the notion of finding that Burnt's case should have been found to be moot.
It brings me to my second question. Your proposition says a judgment assessing points in a traffic offender's record and the effect those points will have on future insurance premiums and on the insurability of the offender constitute sufficient disability.
Yes.
Where in the record can I find that?
Okay. First of all, the points themselves are clearly in the record of the Court of
yes.
Appeals, and they were clearly assessed at the time of the
I'm more
decision.
Concerned with the future insurance premium
Correct.
Effect and the insurability of the future
Right.
insurability of the offender.
I raised that issue in opposition to the motion to dismiss.
But where in the record can I find, not your argument, where is there any evidence of that?
The court did not have any record opportunity to present a factual record on that. I mean, I certainly am drawing upon the decisions of the courts of appeals that have all said that.
But there's no statement of proceedings, no stipulated facts, nothing presented to the Court of Appeals.
Because, Your Honor, the issue came up in the context of the motion to dismiss being revived by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals ruled originally against the state.
So other than your argument to the appellate court, it doesn't exist.
On the insurance issue, it's representations of counsel respecting that. That's right. And it's then those
for brief?
That's right. And it's based on the issues relating to the raised by these appellate districts, one of which, the 7th District, I think, specifically talked about the insurance issues. So, I mean, that's how it comes up in that context. I'm actually surprised. I have a healthy bit of respect for Mr. Cassay. I've known him for a long time in Summit County, and I'm actually surprised that he doesn't think that mootness can come up in the trial court level. It's one of the four pillars of justiciability: mootness, political question, standing, and advisory opinions. And any time that a court is being called upon to render an advisory opinion or confront someone that doesn't have an issue presented by someone without standing, the trial court clearly has those kinds of issues before it, and clearly mootness can come up in that context. The reason I raised that in response to what Mr. Cassay had to say was that the doctrines of waiver and estoppel are well recognized among the standard principles of mootness in this state as grounds for taking on a case that otherwise might be considered by the court to be moot. In this case, I would respectfully submit that by failing to move to strike the objections that were filed in the court, in the juvenile division, at the time those objections were filed, my client already had paid the court costs and fines. So the issue was joined possibly at that point. By failing to raise it, at a minimum, the state invited error, but probably here has engaged in an act of waiver or estoppel within that part of the doctrine of mootness that applies in this state. So I would ask the court to take a look at that as it reaches through all of these standards of mootness that I have outlined in my briefs. Lastly, I would ask the court specifically to focus on this language at page 237 of the Wilson opinion in 1975. The case says, the issue of mootness of a criminal case arises only if it is shown that there is no possibility that any collateral legal consequences will be imposed upon the basis of the challenged conviction. And that, of course, I think would apply in the context of juvenile proceedings as well, where the issue of culpability comes up in that context. Your Honors, I believe that in this case, the court, in order to allow the Ninth District's decision to stand, would have to ignore the decisions of five other appellate judicial districts who have weighed in on this issue, and would have to essentially establish for the first time in this state that the mere imposition of points is not enough to meet the Wilson standard. And that I think that the Chief Justice and the other two justices who supplied their decision, rendered their opinions in the dissenting opinion in Berndt, had it correct when they cited this very language of Wilson in essentially saying that the majority didn't quite apply it. That's why you'll notice in my proposed proposition of law that I have indicated that the Wilson and Berndt case ought to be explained and applied in this case. I have not asked that they be overruled. I think, frankly, Wilson does provide my client the remedy he needs, namely to get back to the Ninth Appellate Judicial District and have that court render a decision on the substantive issue that was, in fact, preserved in the record at the trial court. Your Honor, it looks like I have 4 seconds left. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Orhatch. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.